Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Science Studio program. Today is going to be a real winner. I just sense it. I know that our audience has heard the word plasma. I'm sure most of the audience have forgotten exactly what it means. It's to do with electrons and ions. But did you know there's a plasma that's full of gluons and quarks? My goodness, we've really gone out of our way this week to explain something really unusual. And Russ, who's going to be our guide through this gluons and quark morass?
We're very happy to have with us this time Dr. Vladimir Skokoff from the Brookhaven National Laboratory and West Michigan University. And he's here to tell us about semi-quark gluon plasma. Welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Oh, no, we're looking forward to this because this is one of the areas that I think most people get a bit confused about. I mean, first of all, gluons, and then quarks, and then plasma or plasmae. It's going to be interesting. But before we get to that, Vladdy, I think, is the diminutive.
Vladdy's right? Okay, yeah.
Before we get to that, Vladdy, how do we learn, how did you get into being a scientist? What were those moments when you became aware of what you wanted to do, and how did you land up in North America like the rest of us?
Okay, so, I mean, I was always fascinated about science when I was even a child. I don't know why, and I always was, you know, trying to become one. So, and I succeeded.
You sure there wasn't a grandmother involved? She got me involved in science.
You know, I have never met a grandmother or a grandfather, you know, no grandparents whatsoever. And my parents are not scientists. I mean, they're just, you know, workers, usual guys.
So from when you were very young, you were just looking up at the stars and saying, what's going on?
Or maybe this is Soviet educational system. Because in Soviet system, I mean, scientists were considered as like gods.
Yeah, yeah.
Not anymore in modern Russia.
Okay, so then it was clear that for whatever reason, you thought science was fun. The Soviet system clearly encouraged you to show excellence in this area.
Yes.
So how did you choose then physics, for example?
It was also not a choice. I started to study chemistry. Then after some time, I went to mathematics. And finally, I converged to physics.
You were a chemist first, and then you went to physics just because of a professor or interest?
So chemistry deals with molecules. So I wanted to know what is inside of these things, you know, and to learn about that.
So then you got to electrons, and you got to nuclei, and then what?
So let me start from the beginning. So molecules consist of atoms. Atoms are formed from interacting protons, neutrons, and electrons. So essentially, nucleus is interacting proton and neutrons. Okay? So those protons and neutrons consist of quarks and gluons. Okay? So, and I'm trying to study these objects, these tiny constituents of matter. Okay, so gluon and the quarks are basically the blocks of the standard model of modern particle physics, along with, Higgs bosons. And you know that Higgs bosons made a lot of noise recently.
Yes, okay? The God particle.
Exactly. So, and the Higgs boson explains the mass of quarks, for example, right? So, but if you sum up the mass of quark, you will get only 1.5% of the mass of proton. The rest are gluons. And to explain the mass of proton, I mean, the rest 98.5% of the mass of proton, you really need to study interaction between quarks and gluons.
So in other words, the quarks are glued together by these other particles to make a...
Yes, exactly.
Very perceptive. Exactly. I mean, I'd wondered why gluons. So the bottom line there, which I didn't know until now, I'm remembering it again now perhaps, is that the mass of the proton really comes from the gluons.
Exactly. And the interacting quarks. It's not because of the Higgs particle, you know. Yeah. I mean, it's the part which is the Higgs particle is responsible for is only 1.5%.
So for those of us that really don't know, now I understand that a proton is basically lots and lots of gluons and a few little quarks. Can we quantify how many gluons there are in a proton and how many quarks? Is that a possibility?
There is a possibility to say absolutely, certainly, how many quarks we have in a proton. It's three.
Okay.
About gluons, it's not that clear. There are lots of gluons. We cannot count them all.
And are all the gluons identical? Are there different types of gluons?
Okay, so gluons has its own character, and this character we call color. Gluons carry two colors, say red and blue, or red and anti-blue. There are altogether three colors and three anti-colors. So if you count them all, you will get something like 8.
Okay.
So let me ask this question then. I know that we observe quarks.
Yes.
How about gluons? Can we actually observe them?
Yes, in principle we can see. There are some in collisions of very highly energetic particles. We can see the so-called gluon jets. When you have 3 jets from this collision, and these 3 jets characterize the gluon interaction. So you can probe gluon interaction in those events.
So these are high energy experiments that you would do at a ring where you had very high energy protons crashing into each other, and then you look at the fragments.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So say experiments here in the United States at Fermilab, Brookhaven National Laboratory.
The other thing that I would like to know is that most of us who are chemists and so on, we sort of understand electrons and protons and atoms and chemistry and so on. How does this affect us? Why is it important for us to understand this? Now, I understand that we need to understand the universe, but if we understand gluons and so on and so forth, is there anything that happens that is very important to us?
There are several interesting facts about that. I mean, first of all, by studying these quarks and gluons, we are studying the early universe. I mean, how it was expanding, how it was evolving, and the properties of these gluons. Of course, we cannot apply this knowledge right away about the quarks and gluons to, you know, for industry. We cannot do that at the moment. But, you know, when Maxwell wrote his equations, he also couldn't do that. Okay, but nowadays, you see. There are, of course, the fundamental things we would like to study about the quarks and gluons. For example, how they form this proton, okay? How we can change this proton mass. We would like to study about astrophysical objects, like neutron stars, very compact stars with high density, about supernova explosions, too. So, and all this information is hidden inside a proton.
Because I know that's an interesting topic right now about inside a neutron star or something, you have a tremendous pressure and weight and heat like that. So the reactions of gluons and so on are more happening there than anywhere else. And so it seems to me that some of these things that we've talked about in Science Studio, like dark energy, dark matter, are related to these subjects.
In principle, they can be. I mean, some researchers say that these are called quantum chromodynamics. The theory which studies interactions between quarks and gluons is responsible for dark energy. Okay, so we don't know, but there are some theories that claim something like that. So it's also interesting to study. I mean, 70% of nowadays universe we don't understand. 70%.
And I think that's something that, to me, should get the students interested in physics, right? Because when I was in my degree, the universe, we knew it was expanding, contracting, everything was known. Now all of a sudden it's going infinitely, and this is a really interesting question.
Indeed. Let's go to the next sort of line along. We thought naively that, you know, there was such a thing as an atom. It was the smallest particle. And now we know that there's neutrons and there's electrons. And now we know that there's not only neutrons and protons, but there's gluons and quarks. Are we expecting then that a gluon will in fact have multiple components that make its construction? Or is that just...
come apart again?
Yeah. How far down can we keep going? And then when does it become a mathematical ploy as opposed to knowledge?
You know, so at this moment, as we speak, we can only go down to quarks and gluons. All the rest are speculations. There are some theories which claim that at smaller scale you have another particles which are called prions. So, however, nobody knows if it's true or not. There is another part of physics which is called string theory, which is claimed that behind any particle there is a string with a certain, you know, frequency. So, again, we don't really know if it's true or not. At the moment, we cannot prove that, and we have to go to very, very high energies to probe these.
But it's the mathematics that is sort of driving the theory, right? I mean, the mathematicians have been able to come up with this string theory, and it looks so elegant.
I do not agree. Actually, you know, the string theory started from interacting quarks and gluons, you know? So it was put forward by a physicist, Leonard Susskind. He's here in the United States. And it was used to describe the interaction between two quarks with a spring in between. And this is when the string theory started. And from that, it developed to something else.
So quarks in that idea used to go around as pairs?
Yeah, I mean, I consider the quarks as just two balls and a spring in between. That's it.
Yeah, but so they're sort of tied for all time together as pairs.
Yes, exactly.
Right, and that's where it came from. But then that was an imaginative concept.
Yes.
What was then later on taken on by the mathematicians to sort of be able to give it some fundamental reality.
It was developed like that. So the people started to work in this direction after Leonard's paper. And they saw some misconceptions in this theory. And they found out that this theory will be, you know, mathematically okay only in 23 dimensions.
Yeah.
And then it's separated from, you know, from this physics of quarks and gluons, which we can study in laboratory, and started as its own subject, you know, about 23 dimensions.
Yeah.
And
so on. So I would say that, and this is something very interesting to me, you as a theorist.
Yes.
You know, I use Kahn theory, and I always insist that I have experiment to go with it so nobody argues, all right? But where you are, you're always arguing with other theorists. And tell us a little bit about how that works. I mean, you have a theory and somebody else says you're wrong and you say you're right.
You know, we always have a test. It's experiment. Every time, every day, we have some conflicting theories. I mean, at present, for example, we wrote a paper about something. And some people disagree, I mean, quite strongly. And experiment just, you know, 2 days ago, I saw experimental data showed that we are right. So that's it.
Oh, boy, that's a nice victory, isn't it?
Yeah, experimental data from where? From the Brookhaven lab? Or?
So this time it's from CERN. It's from a Large Hadron Collider.
Right.
You're looking for experimental evidence, and you were talking about before some you know, people that were way advanced that the experimental evidence didn't come until after they were dead.
or, you know, even longer. That's right.
Wait, what does that mean, even longer? I mean, once you're dead, it seems to me.
Because to probe the string
theory... Not in 23 dimensions, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Because to probe the string theory constituents, the strings, you need to go to the scales of Planck scale. So it's very, very high energies.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name's Keith Paddle. I'm here with Russ Chianelli. And our guest today is Dr. Vladimir Skokov, currently at Central Michigan University.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. You can now go into a store and buy a 3D printer to print a tool or a camera part. So 3D printers will soon change how we live, but maybe whether we live as well.
Researchers have printed mini kidneys, spinal discs, and now mini human livers. These livers are only 0.5 millimeter thick and 4 millimeters long.
The technology is really pretty amazing. The printer uses liver cells called hepatocytes and stellate cells, printing 20 layers of them in precise spatial patterns that resemble the natural liver.
Hepatocytes are the most prevalent type of liver cell, and stellate cells are vital to liver regeneration.
The experiment didn't use an artificial scaffold, so it more closely resembles the natural organ. They also included cells that line blood vessels to create a meshwork of small channels to provide oxygen and nutrients to extend the life of the liver.
The mini liver produced albumin, which is a protein that helps move small molecules through the blood, such as bilirubin, progesterone, and medications. It also synthesized cholesterol and produced key detoxifying enzymes called cytochrome P450s that metabolize drugs and toxins to protect the body.
These mini livers appear to be working like the real thing. Researchers aim to print a full-size liver, but a major challenge is to print larger branched networks of blood vessels to deliver nutrients to the liver.
Overcoming this obstacle would save many lives. More than 16,000 Americans are waiting for a liver transplant. Imagine one day having 3D printers print any organ a person needed to replace a failing one.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Vladimir Skokov on the faculty at Central Michigan University, physicist, really fascinated and knowledgeable about gluons, quarks, and how the two of them together can form a plasma. So let's get on to that particular branch of your knowledge. What is a plasma And then what are gluons and quarks doing with things that we didn't even associate as plasmas?
Okay, so usually plasma consists of electrons and ions. And, you know, we always try to learn this, how this plasma interact.
But first of all, let the audience know how do you create and even observe a plasma? I mean, we all know we can see a crystal in the solid state. Yeah. We know water is a liquid and alcohol, but we don't see plasmas very often.
I mean, usual plasma you can see every day. I really think so.
Tell us.
For example, a flame is a plasma. It's a usual electrodynamical plasma.
So because it contains?
It contains free electrons and free ions.
Okay.
That fly together and interact. It's a plasma, and you can, you know, study it at home. Okay, so of course we are studying the plasma of quarks and gluons. You can do it at home. For that, you have to build an accelerator, a collider. So you have to accelerate the nucleus to a very high speed, almost the speed of light, and collide. In this collision, a lot of energy is deposited. This kinetic energy of this nucleus goes into internal degrees of freedom. These internal degrees of freedom makes those quarks inside of protons and neutrons and gluons too, to liberate those particles which are hidden there in protons and nucleus. For a very short amount of time, something like 10 to the minus 23rd, it's tiny amount of time, but this time is right enough to study this plasma, to study these quarks and gluons. The temperature of this plasma is much higher than the temperature of sun. It's 7.2 trillion degrees. I mean, think about that. It doesn't matter Fahrenheit, Celsius, or Kelvin because of this.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a question that anybody standing outside will say, well, you know, I can measure my temperature through a thermometer. And yeah. Nowadays, I go to the doctor and they wipe something across my forehead and it comes up with a number. How on earth do you get to that temperature? What's the measurement that you do to say, this is the temperature? And is this plus or minus a million or what? I mean, give us a clue.
Yeah, of course. I mean, the object is we are studying is so small and lives so short that we cannot use thermometer. But we can use the particles which shine from this little object. And light is shining from this object. And by studying these light properties, the spectrum of photons, we can find out what is the temperature is there.
Okay. So then we've got this particular plasma.
Yes.
And it's been discovered when? When were the first time people really began to say, hey, wait, this is a plasma-type material?
It was speculated already for 20 years. I mean, first theory came up with this idea.
Right.
And it's quite simple idea. If you have quarks and gluons, probably you can, you know, liberate them from protons and you can form a plasma.
Does this go back to Gell-Mann in his theory?
Oh, I don't think so. I think that, I mean, the first time the quark-gluon plasma was used by Edward Shuryak, a professor in Stony Brook University. And it was something like 20, maybe 25 years ago.
So we have this plasma of gluons, yes, and quarks, and it lasts an infinite small amount of time, an infinitely high temperature. What does it do? How does that dissipate its energy, and what does it produce? Plasma state to what?
Yeah, so, I mean, this plasma starts to expand. I mean, the pressure which is there is so great that it expands almost with the speed of light. And as it expands, it cools down. And when it cools down, the quarks and gluons are again get to bound into the protons and neutrons and other particles, which I don't want to talk about. But anyway, so, and those particles we observe in our experiments. And by properties of those particles, we can tell something about the quarks and gluons in this collision.
So there's a collision of material.
Yes.
And then the protons get blasted apart into the gluons and to the quarks. They then cool down as they expand, and then the quarks and the gluons recombine.
Yes.
So this is a sort of a reversible process.
Exactly.
But some of the energy has been lost. And that's creating, or that energy that's taken away is new particles and things of that nature.
We don't necessarily need this machine to do this, right? This is occurring in new cores of sun and core neutron stars. And therefore, as you said in the beginning, this has got something to do with the origins of the universe. So could you talk a little bit more about what we might learn about the origins of the universe?
Yeah, I mean, of course, I mean, if we have a time machine, we can go back 13 billion years, you know, and study the quark and gluon interactions during the early universe. But it's better to recreate these conditions right now here in the laboratory. We cannot really probe the neutron star. You know, we cannot go there. We cannot study. So, but we can do it here in laboratory. And it's quite cheap, actually. It's not that very expensive. For example, what we learned about that this quark-gluon plasma which is formed has the smallest viscosity possible. There's the smallest viscosity which we have ever measured in the universe. Which is interesting, right? So
just remind the audience, viscosity. I mean, they know honey and treacle, it's very viscous, and water is less viscous, and then so on and so forth. So what's the implication?
Okay, so the viscosity tells you how much momentum, if you have two layers, how much momentum of one moving layer goes to another. And there is a lower limit of viscosity. It is surprising, but there is. You cannot go to zero. Even superfluid helium, which supposedly had the smallest viscosity, which is not true anymore because we measured the viscosity of quark-gluon plasma, has finite viscosity. And this viscosity is bigger by something like three times than the viscosity of quark-gluon plasma.
And that was a surprising result for you?
It was a surprising result for everyone.
So there was no theoretician that had gone to predict this?
No one.
Now all the theoreticians have explained it, I'm sure.
Not all of them, but there is some theory behind that. And usually, I mean, when you talk about plasma, you talk about something which is weakly interacting. Okay, so this flame is weakly interacting. But in this case, this small viscosity shows you that this matter created the collision is strongly interacting. So it is the most strongly interacting matter in the universe.
Okay, so I think that we've given the audience a pretty reasonable idea about what's going on and what it is that you're interested in and what we've learned.
Vladdy, in the beginning of the show you were talking about how you didn't know your grandparents and you were in the Soviet system. Could you talk a little bit more about that? Were your grandparents, victims of the war or something like that?
Only partially. So on my one side, the grandparents was in jail because they fought with the Soviet Union government. So on another parents, they just died.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you were feeling during the Soviet collapse? And I don't want to get into Putin now, but we could.
Okay, so it was quite an abrupt change. Like in one day, I mean, I was a small kid actually, so I'm only 33 years old. So the price for ice cream, you know, abruptly changed by a factor of 100.
Oh my God.
Up, of course. So things like that happened those times. But okay, we survived. I mean, the Russian science probably not. So, and actually, I'm one of the victims of this Russian scientific system, which is there presently. So, I got my PhD in Dubna. This is a small town close to Moscow. Mm-hmm. And after my PhD, I was working in Dubna as a scientific secretary of a laboratory which was built in the machine. Now, the machine, the accelerator, to study the heavy ion collisions and quark-gluon plasma too. But after some time, I found out that it's not worth of spending my time to doing that because usually people was not interesting to build a machine. They were interested in the process of building because it brings money,
jobs.
You know?
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
So, and I gave an interview to a local newspaper, which was then reprinted by a wider audience.
You got in trouble for that?
I was fired, you know, next day.
Oh, my God.
And that's how I returned back to real science. I went for a postdoc to Dubna, to Germany, and after that to Brookhaven National Lab. And finally, I'm at Western Michigan.
So what year did the Soviet Union collapse? I think it was around 1988 or something like that.
Yes. I was still in my native town, Saratov. It was pretty bad, but, you know, I mean, I was not that old, and I didn't really... I was not affected by that, but my parents, of course, were.
So, okay, you were fired, but how did you get out of the Soviet Union into Brookhaven? Or
To Germany. I just applied for a usual postdoc, and I was accepted.
When I was working for Exxon, we worked on the oil spill in 89, and in 90 they had the biggest salmon catch ever. Mm-hmm. And that's another story about that, okay? But what happened was that Exxon bought all the salmon. They got in trouble because the price dropped, and they shipped it to the Soviet Union because there was people were starving up there. That you were talking about ice cream being 100 times, and I guess food was hard to get.
No, people usually those times used to get their food just, you know, by going outside and growing it up, you know, themselves, like by farming.
Well, we're certainly happy that you did it. It came here and tell us about quarks and gluons and so on. It's a fascinating subject and one that we really are a little bit confused about. And I guess a lot of the theorists are a bit confused and arguing with each other about it, too.
Of course. I mean, it's a new subject. That's why. It's a frontier of science.
Just we've got a couple of minutes left, and I'm always intrigued. You know, America is full of people like yourself, myself. We've come from a totally different educational system, and now we're right in the middle of an educational system that we're still developing with all different ideas. What do you see as the big difference from the way that you see your students now in the U.S., in Michigan, learning science compared to the way that you did? And where do you see the improvements? Where do you see the things that you think are lacking?
It's a very good question.
Well, finally, we've got one.
It's a tricky question, too, because, you know, all the administrators listen to your answer.
Okay, actually, so in Russia, you don't have freedom to choose any course. It's a rigid program, and you have to attend every class which is written there. That's it. You have a plan.
Is it track, too? They tell you go into language, go into science, go into,
Not like that. So, but if you, for example, pick up physics as your primary, as your major subject, then you have a set of courses with fixed time, and you have to attend them. And you have to pass the exams at certain years. I mean, everything is fixed. Your program is fixed. Here you can...
No flexibility.
No flexibility whatsoever. Here you can play with subjects, right? So... You can move them back and forth, etc. So
I just was at a college up in the Northwest where I found out that 75% of the incoming freshmen who've chosen majors at the end of that first year change majors, right? I mean, and so this is a tremendous opportunity for American students studying. But it also has that other feeling that if you really don't do very well and you don't want to work too hard, I'll change to something different.
Yeah, so in Russia it doesn't work. So
right.
You cannot really change.
In Britain either, very much. It's much more rigid there too.
Yeah, so if you don't want to do that, you just have to start over.
Somewhere else.
Yeah.
And so in the end, which system would you prefer your children to, when you have them, to be in? A rigid system or this very flexible system?
I think the flexible system has some advantages. I mean, first of all, it develops your responsibility for what you choose, okay, for your life.
Right.
And that's good. In Russia, you choose once and you just follow whatever you want to or not. So
we've come to the end of another 28 minutes of high-energy physics from my colleague Russ Chinelli. Thank you so much, Russell, for your very perceptive questions.
And we really want to thank Dr. Vladimir Skokoff from Brookhaven National Laboratory in West Michigan University for being here. And please come back and tell us more about the origins of the universe when you figure it out.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank the audience and, of course, Norma Martinez, our producer, who is going to make a lot of sense out of this rambling conversation that we've just had. Thank you, Norma. Thank you for listening, folks out there, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Paul Herzog, Chief Executive Officer at Memorial Medical Center in Las Cruces, will retire October 31st. Herzog has been the hospital's CEO for the past 9 years. A national search has begun to find his successor. Read more at mcasynapse.org. Support for Synapse comes from Kindred Hospital, a transitional care hospital for extended stay patients.